This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Happy New Year. Welcome to 2022 and to the latest weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week.
We hope you had a great and safe celebration, everyone. And as we turn the page and start fresh on the calendar, we're dedicating this holiday program to our entire Bloomberg Business Week team.
We are indeed. The 2021 news cycle churned perhaps more rapidly than ever before, and the magazine was there each and every week to capture all the key storylines in business and finance, politics, technology, economics, and so much more.
Over the next 2 hours, we'll be reflecting on some of the very best Bloomberg news coverage. We're also going to bring you the best when it comes to travel, autos, food, all to get you primed for 2022 with our friends at Bloomberg Pursuits.
That's coming up a little bit later on. We begin, though, this hour with the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, Joel Weber. And Joel, this past year got started with a bang for your team. You were all set to publish an issue, and then came the riot at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Take us back there.
Well, it's always an especially difficult issue because you're coming straight out of the holidays. You got a cold start, and then all of a sudden January 6th happens. And we typically transmit a cover and cover story at about 3 p.m. on a Wednesday, which is more or less about when everything took a turn for the worse in Washington, D.C. And at that moment, I just looked at the cover that we were about to transmit and realized that we couldn't really let that one go into the wild, knowing that something was happening. At that point, we still didn't totally understand what. So began our own crazy little wild dance to try and figure out how to actually say something about January 6th as the clock was ticking, as the printer was like, where's your cover? Where's your cover story? It was just a little bit of a magazine-making feat in and of itself, and one that I'm so grateful to have a talented staff for because we managed to pull it together.
Well, how did you handle something like that from a storytelling perspective? Because if you think about where we are now, almost a year later, we're still learning about what happened on January 6th. We're learning about text messages that people, that lawmakers sent.
So I often think about the secret to what we do is trying to take what we know and then also tell you why it matters and what it could mean going forward, which was, I will tell you straight up, almost impossible at that moment. So what we did was rearranged a few things in the magazine, put that cover story and that cover on the shelf, just put it away, stop thinking about it, and actually just started to think about how do we mark this moment? And that's a really significant way that I think when all else fails, just say, this something's happening here, how do we mark that moment? Because we actually, the timing of the way the magazines come together, you actually have to transmit that cover before you have to transmit the story. So that was an example. We actually did a cover.
You had to put the cart before the horse.
Exactly. And it said New Low. It was a shot of the Capitol with the basically mid insurrection. And once we had that out of the way, then it was sort of attempting to account for everything that we could actually say in the magazine, which we kept the pages open as late as we possibly could. I think by the time it was all done, I think we were transmitting the story at about 11 p.m., which allowed us to basically know that the Capitol by that point had become secure and that in the not too distant future, lawmakers were going to come back into the Capitol and actually do what they had set out to do. And so what we did really was just try and put together a timeline of what we knew of what had happened at that moment in time. And it was a first draft of history, which is sometimes what journalism looks like. And that's what it was. Mm-hmm. But we had the foresight enough to know it was a new low. And we stitched together truly like the most remarkable part was just working at Bloomberg News. We had people there in the Capitol who were affected by this and also covering what happened outside the building. So we had a lot of material to pull on. And obviously there were plenty of people coming from all over the place just pitching in with stuff. So it became a huge team sport. We actually just used the Bloomberg version of Zoom called Nexi, and we just were, the magazine group was just huddled in a Nexi trying to figure out, and we were all looking at layouts putting it together in real time. It was really compelling.
So politics are where we started, but as 2021 went on, it became clear that the financial world would also find itself in uncharted waters as well. Let's bring in Bloomberg Businessweek Markets and Finance Editor Pat Regnier to help us put that in perspective. And I know one of the December cover stories kind of summed it up so well: investing's wildest year. It was nuts.
I'd even go so far to say it was investing's weirdest year. I've been through a few bull markets in my life, and I've never seen anything like this. People reach for comparisons to the dot-com era. That was my first professional bull market. But I actually think that this was stranger, involved a wider group of people, a younger group of people. Different kinds of assets that I think people hadn't really had a chance to think about before. We have just tried to watch it, and we've seen it change. You know, this to get into the making of this cover package was something that we started to conceive of in some ways all the way back in summer after the sort of the Reddit and GameStop affairs, which we covered. And we were kind of thinking, like, we want to talk about how it seems like everybody we know is becoming a kind of a trader. And then, you know, the meme stocks kind of went off the boil for a little bit. you haven't made a lot of money on the meme stocks after that point. And we thought, well, okay, so maybe that moment was over, and it wasn't. You know, as Mike Regan described it, this hasn't been so much an inflating bubble as a series of waves that just keep coming and crashing on the shore just to be followed by another. And now we're really looking at crypto, and not just Bitcoin, in fact, not even primarily Bitcoin.
Well, the way you guys have covered everything throughout when it comes to markets and just our changing investment themes has been just pretty incredible. Our thanks to Bloomberg Businessweek Markets and Finance Editor Pat Regnier, as well as Joel Weber. He's going to stick around with us. We're going to take a look coming up next, some of the areas the market spurred on by the pandemic, especially big pharma and the race to develop a COVID vaccine.
You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
If 2020 was defined by the emergence of COVID-19, 2021 was dominated by headlines about vaccines. You know, pharmaceutical companies all engaging in a race to develop those life-saving shots at a breakneck pace.
Well, to help us understand some of the past year's biggest business themes, we welcome in Bloomberg Businessweek Assistant Managing Editor Jim Ellis and the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber, who's also still with us.
So, Joel, what was some of the conversations that you guys were having in the newsroom about, like, how do we, you know, cover COVID this year? I mean, it really was largely about vaccines.
Right. And if you rewind the clock to late December, we actually did a good business cover story called Miracle on Ice, which was, at that point, we're transmitting and transporting all the mRNAs on dry ice, which was a feat in of itself, just to get the first, you know, waves of Americans vaccinated. And slowly but surely, we saw an amazing rollout. And millions upon millions of Americans over the course of the year get vaccinated, and obviously many, many more around the world of all different types of the vaccines. That is an amazing accomplishment in and of itself. Like, the science to get that vaccine made within a year, and then to have so many people around the world actually protected, that in and of itself, just huge feat. What we've also just been all over as a newsroom, I think, is just covering these companies and what they're doing and how well the science is going to hold up against the boosters. And, you know, I think we've been very focused on the Pfizers and the Modernas and the J&Js, and maybe to a lesser extent, at least here in New York, like focusing on the ones that are international. But I think that international part has actually been a huge part of the story. Geopolitically, there's this soft power struggle with China, and China's trying to get its vaccines a lot of places. The nonprofit COVAX has actually struggled to really get a lot of vaccines to emerging corners of the world. That remains a huge issue because, you know, most recently here with Omicron, like, we're going to continue to see variants, and they will probably come from other places, right? And the nature of COVID is that it can morph and mutate very quickly. And as we're seeing now, this is highly transmissible, maybe less lethal, but highly transmissible. And you know, against it all, we've got a we've got vaccines that that seem to work.
Well, Jim, come on in here and talk a little bit about one of the stories that I remember from the past year, which was the changing view of pharmaceutical companies. Because I think for a lot of people, certainly politicians, they were seen as sort of boogeymen, punching bags throughout many of the past years. But there's sort of this changing public perception associated with vaccine makers.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that, you know, this definitely did was change the views that a lot of people had of Big Pharma as basically being that big companies that were all out to make a lot of money off of essentially the health of other people. And I think that when we had a crisis where all of a sudden we were dependent on, you know, Pharma to sort of come up with a solution in record time, I think it actually bolstered the view that most people have of them. I mean, it's a true sort of a sort of success story here. I mean, typically, you know, any kind of pharmaceutical is developed over the course of years of, you know, sometimes years of lab work, then years of you know, going through trials and trying to get approvals. And this was done lickety split. I mean, a lot of this work was done in the course of a year, and then we sort of we're able to fast forward through the normal approval process, because even though people like to talk about approvals, most of these drugs were basically just authorized. They were just a, you know, fast track to get out there and get out. But that's also been one of the things that causes a challenge for them going forward, which is that a lot of anti-vaxxers and people who just want to complain about you know, the restrictions that go along with masking, vaccines, whatever, are saying, well, these aren't real. I mean, look at, you know, the fast forwarding that happened here. Look at the fact that they're authorized but not approved and whatever. But in the end, there was very, very good science, and this is science that's been actually reviewed probably more than almost any drug prior to this, and certainly it's being used by, you know, most of the world now with very good results. And so this is quite an amazement for an industry that used to take it on the chin as being sort of greedy and non-public based.
Yeah, and I remember a great cover story when it comes to vaccine passports. I want to shift gears a little bit, no pun intended, but you guys did a lot of coverage about what's going on in the auto sector, electric vehicles in particular, and Tesla, but also the other players. Jim, how did you think about the strategy about that? Because there was so much going on.
I mean, this was definitely the year when I guess a lot of investors, as well as regular people, suddenly started to take the EV business seriously. You've certainly seen it in the you know, market values that have gone on to you know, a lot of new EV startups. That, you know, it's sort of hard to imagine that Rivian, which is a truck maker that's a competitor, I guess you could see, think of its competitor long-term to Tesla, you know, has a market value that's bigger than General Motors. I mean, this is a company that even this year only planned to produce 1,200 units. That's it, 1,200 trucks. And they're not even going to make that. I mean, they announced that they, this today, but they're not going to make that. Yet, they've got these, you know, sort of multi-billion dollar valuations because investors are convinced that, you know, this is, there's a change afoot here, that, you know, the internal combustion engine is going to go away, and everybody wants to be in the ground floor hoping that they're going to get the next Tesla. Now, I would probably say that's very unlikely, simply because Tesla came into a market that was not there. And Tesla got a lot of attention, and people jumped in because they figured it was the only way. Nowadays, the traditional car companies are jumping in very aggressively. Look at people like Volkswagen with its ID line, which is not only successful, it's becoming successful in China, which had been a, you know, pretty much a Tesla market, and it's becoming successful in Europe. Certainly not a big deal here, but there's a lot of changes that are going to happen in the next couple of years as truck makers get into EVs. And truck makers, that's going to be a really big deal here in the U.S. because the U.S. companies make their money making trucks and SUVs. They do not make money making cars. And so, therefore, they've been willing to let Tesla do its thing. But now that Tesla wants to get into trucks and Rivian and all these other companies are popping up, you know, all of a sudden we're going to see the real competition here.
We're going to talk with Hannah Elliott a little bit later on, too. Certainly the luxury space, you're seeing an explosion as well. All right, guys, we got to run. Thank you so much. Bloomberg Businessweek Assistant Managing Editor Jim Ellis and the editor of Businessweek Magazine, of course, Joel Weber. Thanks, you guys, for joining us. Happy New Year to both of you. And we're looking forward to talking a lot more in 2022.
Well, still ahead on this special holiday weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, we dive deeper into the biggest economic stories that are sure to follow us into the new year. You know them well by now. The I word, inflation,
no,
supply chains.
No.
Also, the great resignation.
Yeah.
All that and more ahead. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, SiriusXM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business app and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
As the U.S. and really the world have transitioned from the depths of the pandemic to an economic recovery over the past 12 months, three themes have emerged that appear to be sticking with us for the foreseeable future: rising prices, supply chain congestion, and a labor force that has left a record number of jobs on the table.
Bloomberg Businessweek economics editor Christina Lindblad is here to help put the past year into some context. So back in November, Christina, the magazine did a takeover section. It really centered around a surge in prices not seen in America in decades. How should we think about this as the Federal Reserve gets ready to end its asset purchases and, look, likely hike interest rates come next year, this year, 2022?
Well, the good news is almost everyone expects prices to moderate next year. The question is how fast. I mean, Powell formally retired the word transitory in November, which I think was a relief to everybody. There are still questions, though, about kind of the balance of what is like this, you know, supply chain factors and demand shock. And maybe once some of the supply chain stuff starts, you know, kind of receding, we'll get a better sense of sort of how much the consumer is driving this. And one of my favorite stories that we did this year was the story about this training that they do at MIT called the Beer Game, which talked about the sort of bullwhip effect that you have in supply chains when people start panic buying. And now, for example, in recent weeks, people have started saying there might be a bullwhip effect in semiconductor supply chains because, you know, companies may be putting in two or three orders because they don't know which ones are actually going to come through. I feel like still there's like dust settling and, you know, like you don't have total clarity on what's happening. But clearly the Fed, in its most recent policy meeting, did a very clear pivot. And in saying that they're just going to speed up the taper, they're basically they're freeing the runway to be able to start to lift off rates.
I always think, though, about your coverage and your team's coverage. It's, you know, and Tim and I talk about it all the time, like inflation, it's a global problem. And supply chain disruptions, they're a global situation. You guys, you know, had to be obviously focusing. We talk a lot about the U.S. and what's going on, but it really is a global, you know, situation with global central bankers having to deal with it.
Right. And some countries are very much ahead of this in the U.S. in tightening. Many in Latin America already have started much earlier in the year trying to get a grip on this.
Politically, you know, we think about the political coverage of this, right? And the idea that politics and in this case, the economy is so intertwined. Josh Green had a story earlier this year that talked about the idea of inflation being, even if it isn't President Biden's fault, and look around the world that you know, central banks around the world and Europe are dealing with this, he's still going to get blamed for it politically.
He is. It's going to be very tough to outrun that.
In a year when we're going to have midterms, right?
Yeah. I mean, they're talking a lot. I mean, they're responding. They're out there talking about how, you know, these task force for shipping, for example, what, you know, they're shouting from the rooftops whenever they see an improvement. But it hasn't, you know, some of the measures they're taking, for example, their efforts to get more domestic capacity to build semiconductors, those are going to take years to yield fruit. Let's see if prices are raging at this level as we get to November. You know, the thing about the inflation story, it has obscured some of the good news story about the economy. I mean, if you compare this recovery to the last one, this is amazing. I mean, at the Fed policy meeting, they basically said we could get to full employment like sometime next year. You know, in the last recovery, 2015 was when we started lifting off rates. You know, yeah. That was when the Fed decided we had gotten back to full employment.
Yeah. Hey, listen, one other thing we want to just talk about is you oversaw a special new economy issue of the magazine in the fall. A bunch of folks, you know, providing you and all of us really with some startling numbers from the youngest members of the global workforce. We're not just having labor problems in the United States. It's happening everywhere.
Yeah, I think there's a segment, especially we put our finger on sort of a demographic effect, you know, with young people which had been overrepresented in the sectors that got slammed by the lockdowns and the pandemic in general, being, you know, they were just thrown off course, really. You know, people who were starting their careers or were sort of in, you know, had accumulated a certain number of years on a job and thought they were going somewhere and just completely thrown off track.
I have a feeling we're going to be talking about the great resignation and inflation a lot and supply chain still. Yeah,
what are they going to call it in 2022?
I don't know.
I'm ready to have some new names for new phenomena.
How about no more pandemic? That would be nice.
Yeah.
Oh, fingers crossed.
Once in a while, people slip up and say, like, now, you know, now in the end of the pandemic, and you're like, what?
Yeah. Didn't get the memo.
Ain't over,
send
folks.
Send it to Omicron.
Yeah, exactly.
Our big thanks to Bloomberg Businessweek Economics editor Christina Lindblad for joining us as always. The major macroeconomic issues we'll be paying close attention to in the coming weeks and in the coming months, as we always do on Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek, our first broadcast of 2022. Up next, we're going to look at some of the favorite feature stories from the year that were in the magazine. You are listening to Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
At the top of our special holiday weekend program, we covered the wildest year investors have ever seen. It has been incredible. Digital currencies have certainly contributed to that, Tim.
We're not just talking about Bitcoin. We're talking stablecoins, too. They're becoming a factor in the growing and often misunderstood part of a growing crypto market.
All right. And one of the coins companies at the center of all of this and the intrigue is Tether. And our features editor at Bloomberg Businessweek is Max Chafkin. He's here to take us back to an October cover story from our own Zeke Fox about what turned into a $69 billion mystery. I got to say, Zeke did some great stories on Tether. And another one we'll talk about in a moment. We're talking about the SPAC King.
Yeah. So Tether, if you follow the crypto world at all, it's super important. It's one of the most heavily traded coins out there. It's basically the main way that people who are trading crypto get in and out of say Bitcoin or anything else. And you know, it's widely used as Zeke talks about. But within this world, there's just this sense, and this includes among many, you know, many of the crypto heads, many of the people who use this currency, you know, every day, that it's not totally normal. It's sort of like a bank account in the sense that, you know, the Tether's big brand promise is that you will give it a dollar and it will give you these coins that are in theory exchangeable at any point for an equal amount of kind of U.S. currency, and yet, for a long time, no one has known exactly where Tether is keeping these coins. Said it had reserves, but it's never been clear. And we sent Zeke Fox, you know, on a mission to try to solve the mystery.
Okay, so this involved a former child actor who'd missed a penalty shot in the Mighty Ducks, a crypto billionaire named Brock Pierce, a worldwide journey. What did he find?
So yeah, I mean the Tether, it's so colorful, and in a lot of ways, it really reflects kind of both the money and also the craziness of this world. You know, you left out like three other crazy things about Brock Pierce. At one point, he employed Steve Bannon, you know, Trump's, you know, one-time consigliere. He also ran for president. Basically, the company has had trouble with banking relationships for the same reason that a lot of crypto companies have had trouble. As a result, and this is according to Zeke's reporting, which Tether disputed in places, Tether had to move the money around a lot, and eventually, as we discovered, began putting it into some, you know, pretty questionable investments, at least for a company promising the kind of stability that Tether has been promising. So we're talking about, you know, large quantities, basically, of Chinese commercial paper. And again, these investments are normal investments. They're just not normal investments for a bank. And so that creates some question, you know, both in part of kind of like crypto critics, but also economic regulators, that maybe this currency you know, if the crypto market started to collapse, this currency could lead to a lot of, you know, economic contagion, not just in the crypto market, but in other financial markets, because it owns so much of this commercial paper.
I mean, Business Week was so incredible and really just, you know, covering what was a wild year in financial markets. And that included, you know, SPACs. They're not new, we know that, but we definitely saw a huge wave, especially earlier this year. We're talking about those special purpose acquisition companies, those Blake Jenk companies. Zeke had another story on what we have, or what you guys called, or who you guys called, the SPAC King.
Yeah, this is Chamath Palihapitiya. Really recommend this profile if anyone missed it. He is a fascinating figure who's just been kind of right in the middle of not just the sort of SPAC boom, but many other like sort of hot trends in the world of technology and money. So Chamath Palihapitiya basically became Facebook's growth guy just as Facebook was growing. He was an early Facebook employee, sort of friend of Mark Zuckerberg. Then he got in on kind of the green investing boom, and now he's on to SPACs. And he is, you know, just an amazing marketer, an amazing kind of like packager of you know, investing ideas and of his own personal brand. And he has really found a way to, you know, make a lot of money taking these companies public. But of course, the way that SPACs are structured, you know, it's going to be great for Chamath Palihapitiya. It's not clear that that SPAC investors are going to do quite so well, because the way these deals are structured, you know, they really work out well for the SPAC sponsors, not necessarily for the individual investors.
Yeah, we're talking about companies like Virgin Galactic, ticker SPCE, SoFi, Clover Health, Open Door Technologies as well. I'm wondering, though, because this has also coincided with a time where SPACs have kind of lost their luster over the last year. I mean, if we think about what the inanimate object of the year on the Bloomberg 50 list was for 2020, right, it was SPAC. Not in 2021, though.
Yeah, and that's kind of what, I mean, this was even happening, you know, at the time we wrote this story, which was, you know, way back in May. And, you know, the cover lines was blank check companies hit the wall. And you know, the point was that, you know, the market was already starting to kind of get a little bit soft, and these SPAC sponsors were doing quite well, and so that certainly happened, and you know, that's not to say that like that these companies are necessarily, you know, all bad companies, but we did have a situation where you had a bunch of kind of really smart finance guys who were able to kind of take advantage of a moment, and with Chamath Palihapitiya, you know, it wasn't just kind of realizing that SPACs were a big deal, but it's kind of like the whole meme stock thing. I mean, he got, you know, when the Wall Street Bets thing happened, you know, he threw himself into the middle of that. He's been very good at kind of both recognizing that world and of course profiting from it. But of course, you know, that some of that interest has died down, and we've seen a lot of these stocks, you know, fall back to earth, and that's you know, creating some, you know, losses for anyone who kind of bought into the hype at the wrong moment.
Hey, Max, we hit on politics at the top of the show with Joel Weber, and talking about the chaos of the riot at the Capitol back on January 6th. In the months that followed, we learned a lot about a group called QAnon and the conspiracy theorists around the nation. We also learned that they needed tech support as well, and that's where Nick Lim comes in.
Yeah. So Nick Lim, as we wrote about in this piece, which, you know, it was so weird and mind expanding, is basically the webmaster to all of the kind of unsavory groups of the internet. He runs a company. He's a sort of radical free speech advocate, and he runs a company that provides back end web services, you know, to the likes of basically QAnon supporters and other folks who are not able to get server space and technical support, you know, from big companies like Amazon. And what's really interesting about this story, first of all, it's like a window into this weird subculture. You know, Nick Lim is a total character. I mean, you know, he's like about 180 degrees removed from like, you know, the folks running like Amazon Web Services, but he's kind of in the same business. And he shows, number one, you know, just how much power these companies have, you know, Amazon and these companies that provide either basically, you know, web services, you know, servers to websites, or security firms that prevent websites from getting hit with denial of service attacks, which is actually the business that this guy Nick Lim is in, they basically have enough power to essentially take someone off the internet unless another company steps in. And that's kind of who that's kind of what Nick Lim is doing. And so he is kind of the service provider of last resort to these kind of unsavory groups. And it sort of shows you, number one, how much power Amazon has, but also if you want to kind of crack down on QAnon, or you want to crack down on white nationalists, or you want to, you know, crack down on violent extremists, it's pretty hard, because there's always going to be somebody out there who's basically willing to do business with them and keep them on the internet.
Hey, Max, before we let you go, speaking of technology, we want to hit on Apple. The Mark Gurman and Austin Carr piece about Tim Cook that hit back in February, it called at the time, and this is kind of, I'm chuckling, right?
Sounds quaint, doesn't
it? Yeah, $2.3 trillion fortress. Now the number that we're talking about is in focused on right now is $3 trillion in market cap.
I know.
How has Tim Cook been able to avoid a lot of the heat that the other big tech CEOs have felt over the past year plus?
So I think some of this has to do with, and you know, not even the past year, but going back during the Trump era,
right? The trade war with the Trump administration.
Yeah, and, you know, no company arguably was as vulnerable to kind of the currents of nationalism, isolationism. You know, the sort of wave that Trump was riding, you would think would crash right down on Apple, because Apple makes all of its products at the time, right? It was making like all of its products in China, or most of its products in China, and also its most important, you know, new growth market is China. So you would think like this would be a company that would be, you know, kind of uniquely vulnerable. And you know, as the story shows, you know, Tim Cook is a very savvy business person, and like a very savvy user and director of global markets, and he's also a pretty savvy politician.
Wow, unbelievable deep dive into it. And it is really pretty remarkable, considering so many big tech CEOs really on certainly politicians' radar, and to see how Tim Cook really navigated it and going from administration to administration. Max, it was an incredible year of your team. Really some great dives, and I highly recommend everybody check them out online if you did not get to read them. What a great year you've had in your team.
Yeah, thank you.
And also shout out for Max. It was a big year for Max as well. His new book, The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power, it came out back in September. If you haven't read it, it is a great book. Check it out. Max, congratulations.
Thanks a lot.
All right, Max, happy new year. Max Chafkin, features editor at Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. And that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Businessweek from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovec. Coming up in our next hour, we ring in the new year with the team at Bloomberg Pursuits. We're going to give you the best tips on travel, cars, food, and all forms of luxury for the coming year. Maybe even talk about luxury in the metaverse. Stick
it's
around.
A thing.
It is a thing. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovec.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. It's a special hour. It's all things pursuits, travel, luxury autos, food. The Bloomberg Business Week Pursuits team has some of the best jobs in the business. It's always fun to get some time with them.
And we're very pleased to have the head of our Pursuits team with us for the rest of the broadcast. Chris Rouser is here to help us welcome in 2022 in style. By the way, you and Nikki, I know I say this all the time, you have the best jobs here.
Well, I'm the one that stays at the desk and edits things.
Okay.
So mostly Nikki and Hannah and Kate have the best jobs.
Does somebody ever come to you and they're like, yeah, we need to go to like some really posh place in, I don't know, south of France. And you're like, I don't think that's like, I don't know. It sounds really good, but it sounds like a boondoggle.
Yes, that happens all the time.
All right. So let's get to someone who checks out a lot of great places that we can all go to. Let's talk about travel. I mean, many of us started getting back on planes, maybe even cruise ships, and the travel and hospitality world was more than ready. Nikki Eckstein is the Bloomberg Pursuits travel editor. She joins us as well. First of all, Nikki, you know, what was your year like, and some of the storylines that were jumping out as the world did kind of start to reopen, right?
Hey, you guys. Well, okay, first of all, there's never a bad time for the south of France.
Well said.
And second of all, I didn't quite get that far this year. I have a small child who's still not old enough to be vaccinated. And you know, that's a consideration for families and for me. So I was cautious, like a lot of other people in the world. You know, it's kind of crazy. International arrivals are still down 75%. So you look at Instagram, you think everyone's going everywhere. We're really still keeping it close to home. But people dreamed big this year, and that helped a lot.
How did, you know, coming off of lockdowns and coming at the same time as the rise of vaccinations make you think about 2021 when it came to writing about travel for Pursuits?
Oh, man, 2021 was a real roller coaster ride for us over here. If you think about where we were at the beginning of the year, we were just starting to see the hope that came with vaccines. Borders were largely closed. We were still grounded, right? So at the beginning of the year, we were still taking an incredibly cautious stance where we were really talking about what CEOs were saying and predicting within the travel industry, what innovations were happening to allow travel to start coming back, how businesses were responding to the ongoing crisis that just kind of kept going and going and still does. And then as the middle of the year hit and borders started to open in time for summer vacations, we started to pivot to, you know, letting ourselves dream a little bit and put some practicalities in place for people. How should I think about traveling now that I'm vaccinated? What's safe? And where should I go? And what am I going to do when I'm there? So we've run that gamut. And now here we are at the end of the year with Omicron. Who knows what's happening next?
And throughout the year, Nikki oversaw a series of very helpful pieces where we talked to bureau chiefs in different cities around the world to get a lay of the land of what it's like there now. So, you know, you may be able to look online about what the like vaccine requirements are if you're going to go to London or Miami or Paris. But okay, is it fun to go? Is it, right. Does it feel good? And so, you know, once every couple of weeks, we had a different journalist in these cities say, okay, here's what it's like. Here's what neighborhoods people are hanging out in. And, you know, does it feel comfortable? Yeah, people are going out. Does it feel really restrictive? Is it safe? And there's also an amazing travel tracker graphic where you can actually search the rules between where you are and where you want to go, which the graphics team built. So we had a lot of data to help people, you know, figure these kinds of things out. But Nikki did a tremendous amount of work just figuring out, you know, what the outlook was, what the changes would be. And we actually have a piece coming up in our Year Ahead issue where she says, like, here's what the travel recovery was that wasn't.
Yeah,
and, you know, Nikki, what are some of the places that kind of did okay this year?
Places that lent themselves to outdoor leisure trips, generally on beaches. Hmm. So in the U.S., that was the Florida Keys. The Florida Keys had a runaway success of a year. And in Europe, interestingly, it was the Turkish Riviera that was the number one performer. And both of those markets exceeded their 2019 norms by kind of all the standard industry metrics. And it was really like a big cash cow of a year for them. And then cities did really, they did poorly. You know, they struggled. They had a hard time because they're so dependent on business tourism. And that's still not a thing. There were two sides of the coin. And in terms of hotels, you know, if you were Blackberry Farm or Amangiri or Ranch at Rock Creek, these are all U.S. luxury resorts that are based on heavily outdoor experiences, leisure
pursuits. I want to go now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Carol's like,
you can't.
Spectacular settings, great Smoky Mountains, you know, Utah National Parks. Like, these are the types of places that people felt comfortable in and still fed that wanderlust, that desire to go somewhere that will jaw drop.
Got to ask you about Richard Branson, the Virgin Voyages, no kids. Tell us what was going on, because the cruise line industry was just decimated during the shutdown. But this was like a different kind of cruise, right?
Oh, my goodness. So Richard Branson has been talking about his cruise line since well before the pandemic, and it's called Virgin Voyages. The whole kind of marketing premise was trying to get young millennials who think that cruising is the least cool thing on the planet to buy into this concept, a cruise ship where they would be in each other's company and actually be able to have like edgy nightlife and really awesome cutting edge food and beverage, you know, things that would feel at home in the East Village of New York and not on a Royal Caribbean cruise ship. The poor concept just got dragged on in a series of pandemic-induced delays. And finally, they were able to set sail on their maiden voyages this past fall. And we sent our cruise correspondent on the maiden voyage, and the stories that she told were just spectacular. It sounds literally like Burning Man on a cruise ship, but for all ages.
Sometimes it's the south of France. Sometimes it's a Virgin Cruise. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm going to say. Hey, Nikki, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it. Our thanks to Bloomberg Pursuits travel editor Nikki Eckstein. Chris Rouser, he's going to stay with us for the rest of the hour. And coming up next, we're going for a ride.
Yeah, we're going to be speaking to Hannah Elliott. She's Bloomberg's auto columnist. She's going to talk all about demand for cars of all types being a big trend in 2021. We're going to get her favorites.
If you could get the car, I'm just going to put it out there.
Yeah, chip shortage.
This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Earlier in our New Year's broadcast of Bloomberg Business Week, we talked about the growing impact of electric vehicles on the global auto markets. I mean, it's not just about Tesla.
It's definitely not just about Tesla. And here to talk all things electric vehicles and more is editor of Pursuits, Chris Rouser, also Bloomberg Pursuits auto columnist Hannah Elliott joins us now. Chris, I want to start with you and just talk a little bit about how you and the Pursuits team approach auto coverage when thinking about the types of stories that you want to tell for the Business Week audience.
Well, for us, it's a mix of fantasy and reality. So we love to talk about the cars that you use and why you use them. So why would you buy a Rivian electric truck? Why would you buy maybe an electric sedan from Mercedes? Or why would you daydream about a Koenigsegg or a Hennessy supercar that's going to go from 0 to 60 in 1.9 seconds? We try to create a mix of both the fantasy and the reality. And Hannah, who gets to drive all of those cars, is the perfect person to help us figure it out.
So but, Hannah, come on in on this. Like, talk to us about the year that was. I mean, we were still dealing with the pandemic, but you were out there on the road and you were driving some really cool vehicles.
Yeah, you know, I think the way that Chris talked about fantasy and reality is a very good way to characterize the year in electric vehicles specifically. And I say that because this was the year of electric cars. First of all, we had actual drivable electrics come out from Audi, BMW, Mercedes, more from Polestar, more from Porsche. These are all very real electric cars that you can drive. Today, you can drive off the lot if you can get one. I mean, that's another conversation. But these are real cars that you can drive, and that's really exciting. And we're seeing more and more. Everyone is still playing catch-up to Tesla, but we're seeing more and more offered, which is great. And then on the fantasy side, like Chris said, we are seeing, you know, supercars from Koenigsegg that have four seats that are electric to Hennessy's new electric car they're calling Deep Space that has six wheels and it costs $3 million. And, you know, they're not going to make it for a couple more years. And that is something still in the world of fantasy. And then you have automakers like Rivian that are kind of in the middle because they have produced some early cars. They are in the production line producing vehicles, but they are largely untested. So they kind of bridge the gap between the old brands like Mercedes, BMW, Audi that are making electrics, and the brands that are going to be making supercar electrics in the next few years. So it's a whole universe.
Let's talk about the Rivian for a second, because I saw one in the wild. So Rivian makes this.
They barely exist.
Well, it's exactly. A unicorn.
Rivian makes this electric truck, and it's been very highly anticipated. And the company was valued at $1 billion. And you know, they don't really have a lot of products, so we don't really know what this is going to be like. But Hannah reviewed it and took one off road, and then not long after, I saw one in Brooklyn, and I said, "Oh my God!" to the person I was next to. I was like, "It's a Rivian. I've never seen one." And he said, "Well, what is it?" And I was like, "It's an electric truck for people who live in Brooklyn." Yes. So, Hannah, explain what this car is.
That is the perfect way to describe it. Also, Rivian likes to say they want to be the Patagonia of trucks. Which also helps describe it. Basically, they are a 10-year-old startup company founded by a guy named RJ Scaringe, who believes that the electric truck can save the world. And his rationale is that when, you know, 70 to 80% of car sales in the U.S. are built on a truck platform, we should have those be electric because everyone seems to be buying that size of vehicle. And until now, we haven't really had electric pickup trucks. We've had some fleet sales and the hydrogen and other things, but this is really the first electric pickup truck that someone has said, we're going to do this, we're going to do it big, we're going to do it like Tesla did. And the truck is great.
You like this, right?
I do like it. It's not a perfect specimen, but it is really interesting and good. And, you know, Rivian did come up with very interesting things to make it usable for camping and biking and that sort of thing. They've got innovative storage spaces in the truck. It comes with a camp kitchen that you can plug in. It comes with an air compressor so you can pump up your tires out in the sand dunes. It comes with a lot of really great innovations. It's relatively fairly priced. It starts at around $73,000. And the range, you know, they're saying is above 300 miles, which is, you know, par for the course. So it's really interesting, and people are very excited about it.
Hey,
have
Hannah,
we seen very many? No, but we will.
So you liked the Rivian, but, you know, by the time we got to the end of the year, where we are now, it actually wasn't your favorite car of the year. And in fact, it wasn't even an electric car that was your favorite car of the year, which I think probably surprises a lot of people, given that 2021 was the year of the electric car.
Yeah, this is kind of a thing that I want to keep reminding people because, and I know I'm part of the problem, because there's so much hype and excitement around electric vehicles, of course. And this is the most exciting time we've seen in the auto industry in the past 100 years. And it's because of what's happening with electric vehicles. But the thing that we need to realize and remember is that 2% of the cars on the road right now in the United States are electric. Mm. That leaves a big, big chunk of cars that are not electric. And even, you know, in 20 years, the vast majority of cars on the road will still be combustion engine vehicles. So to that end, I wanted to say and just remind people that there are some great conventionally powered vehicles coming onto the market. And my favorite car of the year was the Mercedes-Benz S-Class, which is their big, expensive executive saloon. That is just, it's just perfect. I mean, it's just, it feels like being in a limousine, but not cheesy like a limousine. It feels very stately and stylish.
Is there an EV in your near future?
Personally, I have to say I am a very old-fashioned person. I love driving the EVs for work, but my heart is still tied to the vintage, I have to admit.
Fair enough. Chris, is there an EV in your future?
I think so, yeah. I think they're very zippy, and I can see myself being a person who's not haunted by range anxiety. I think it's a real mental thing that that Hannah talks about a lot, and you know, you need to get over. Either you're the kind of person that's always going to be anxious about that until you learn more, or you can kind of be easy peasy about it. And I think that's me.
I kind of can't wait, right? You and I talk about it all
the
time,
too. Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, Chris and I both live in Brooklyn, and it's like kind of tough with the charging situation there with alternate side parking. And New Yorkers know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. That's Chris Rouser, editor of Bloomberg Pursuits. Also joining us is our Bloomberg Pursuits auto columnist, Hannah Elliott. We love hitting the road with her. We are excited to find out what she's going to be driving in 2022. I'm guessing it's going to be electric. It's going to be hybrid. It's going to be supercars. Probably some motorcycles in there as well.
No, it's going to be her Rolls, right? All right, still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, restaurants acting as cops on vaccine cards and more. It was a tough year for eateries everywhere, and we saw it up close in the dining capital of the world right here in New York City.
Where the survivors go from here and what needs to be on your menu for 2022. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
It has not been easy running a restaurant during the pandemic. You know that. I mean, it's really an understatement. The eateries that have survived nearly 2 years of pandemic uncertainty, still not quite out of the woods yet.
Well, here to give us a snapshot of the restaurant business in New York and beyond New York is Bloomberg Pursuits food editor Kate Crater. Chris Rouser, also the head of Bloomberg Pursuits. He's still with us now. But Kate, I want to start with you. Just give us an idea of where the food industry is in New York, and then move more broadly as we do enter the new year, because the last 2 years, well, they've just been brutal.
Yeah, no, it's been such a roller coaster ride. And I do feel like chefs are working so hard, and just when I think they start to see daylight and things seem like they're calming down, then all of a sudden there's new outbreak, or staffing crisis has been just as you've read and heard, not to mention supply chain, are all putting big squeezes on restaurants and chefs and everybody in the food industry.
As we watched over the past couple of years, we saw so many restaurants close, especially in New York around us, hundreds and actually, I think in the thousands. And and we sort of felt like maybe there was going to be a moment of new reinvention. We were going to rethink the way restaurants looked and behaved. Certainly in New York, we have the outdoor dining sheds, and they have that in a lot of other cities in the U.S. Where are we in terms of reinventing the restaurant, and are we seeing creative new openings either now or going into next year that you're excited about?
You know what? One of the huge success stories of this year was an Indian restaurant called Damaka that's downtown on the Lower East Side, and it's by a group called Unapologetic Indian, and they have done this bright, vibrant, delicious food that's not your average. You know, it's not like just tikka masala. They do. I just finished my best dishes of the year, and they make a paneer that's like from another planet. It's so like lovely and pillowy and delicious with like this great garam masala spice crust. And they have a bunch of new concepts coming next year, including a skewer one and a fried chicken one, and then food that focuses on Calcutta, where one of the owners is from, Rani Mazumdar. And so that's really exciting. Like, it's exciting to think that it's not just steakhouses, you know, in New York City where we love steakhouses, but there's this like fantastic food that we haven't seen that much, that we don't always get to see that much, like real flavors coming through. And that's going to be great. I also think New York City is going to have a really good year because Eric Adams, our new mayor, has really, like, he's vegan. So I bet we'll see even more vegan restaurants. But, you know, he's definitely planted a flag and say people should go out as it's safe for them to go out, of course. But like nightlife and restaurants and everything. So I think that's actually going to help pump up our local restaurant scene here in New York.
Speaking of vegan,
I'm so hungry.
I'm starving. This should be over food and wine right now. Yeah. I'm just going to put it out there.
Kate, speaking of vegan, you were one of the first people to review 11 Madison Park, which switched to an all-vegan menu. And your first experience with it was good. Some other critics notably did not like it. What do you see as the outlook for the flagship vegan restaurant in New York City?
That's such a good question. I think that they are going to continue. You know what I really think, actually, is that they are going to keep doing vegan, like, through the first quarter, maybe two quarters of the year, and then probably just say, you know what, we couldn't. It's not viable.
Wow.
We have to start. I mean, it's not going to become a steakhouse, let's be clear. But I think, like, they might see their way towards certainly at least being vegetarian and using butter and milk. But I also think that restaurant is so, I mean, and I will say, I had a terrific meal on opening night. Like, I really did. Mm. And I would say that review from a critic at a major newspaper in New York, I would call into question some of the things you said, but that's another story. But I would say, I think that as long as there are tourists coming into New York City, As tourism, hoping, knocking wood, that tourism comes back in a big way, there's a huge audience to support a restaurant like that that didn't read about the secret meat room, et cetera, et cetera.
A big thank you to Bloomberg Pursuit's food editor, Kate Crater. We thank her for her time, and I know the hard work that she has covering one of the, I'm kind of being sarcastic, but not being sarcastic too at the same time, because like people look at Kate's job and they're like, this is the coolest job ever, but you know, Kate, you work so hard to bring this stuff to us, and we do really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much, you guys. It's so great to talk to you.
Yeah, Happy New Year, kiddo. Be well.
Happy holidays. Happy New Year.
All right, of course, that's Bloomberg Pursuit's food editor, Kate Crater. I have to say, one of my favorite stories was also, like, the best pizza and, like, going around the country. I'm someone who drives for good pizza, so that's fun. Which also just makes me more hungry.
I mean, look, full disclosure, in the Stenovek household and in the Masser household, if you don't know this by now, if you're longtime listeners, Friday's pizza night, okay?
Yep, totally pizza night.
So we're working toward the weekend.
All right, you're listening to a special New Year's weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, Chris is going to stay with us. We'll unveil some of Disney World's best-kept secrets and tell you how to go shopping in the metaverse. Yep. It's a thing.
This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Winding down our special New Year's weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rouser still with us to put a bow on our first broadcast of 2022.
Let's kick off our final segment by going back to October and a really fun story from Bloomberg contributor Brandon Presser. He went behind the scenes as a worker at Disney World. This was like, I'm thinking back to this.
I love when he goes behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to keep it PG because there's some serious stuff there that, you know, happens at Disney World. Where do you want to start, Chris? Well, remind us
what Brandon does.
So Brandon Presser is a travel journalist and freelance writer who works with us, and he does a series of stories where he goes undercover at luxury establishments and he works there. So he worked as a butler at the Plaza Hotel. He was a ski instructor in Aspen. He worked on mega yachts, and he's done it. He was a flight attendant. He's done it in a ton of different places.
And the companies let him do this?
And we set it up with the companies. Yeah, okay. We don't do that. We don't like
sneak
attack
anybody.
They don't
read his previous stories.
Undercover, right?
See what he's written about.
They do read it. And actually, they do read the stories, and we work with them, and they know what's going on. And because the stories are, he works there and he finds out fun and sort of salacious and silly secrets. So, it is sort of oriented towards finding things that you wouldn't believe about working there. And in almost all of the places, you find stuff that really is a testament to how tough it is to work in those places and how dedicated the people are who work there.
I'm going to say, I'm shocked that Disney allowed him to do this.
Yeah, I think based on the feedback afterwards from Disney, they maybe didn't read all the stories before. But Disney is celebrating their 50th anniversary this year, and so Disney World in Orlando, and they are celebrating it in a lot of different ways, and they wanted to do a highlight of the staff and how hard they work. And this story really highlighted how hard they work because, you know, a lot of... So the staff at Disney World are incredibly well-trained from... You know, every time you see a costumed character out in the park, so maybe you see Ariel, the mermaid, or you see Goofy, there's somebody else standing near them, watching them to make sure that nobody, you know, gets rowdy with them or asks them to do something inappropriate. And they have like little hand signals that they do because most of the costume characters don't talk. And then somebody will come up and sort of intervene, but they never break character, even to the point where if you say, oh, like, I heard you got a job at Disney, I heard you're playing Ariel, a person will say, oh, no, I'm a friend of Ariel's. All the people who are in those roles are friends of the characters.
No one plays anybody, right?
Right.
And what it does, though, and I found reading the article, is that it kind of makes the people who are there, even the adults, think that they're living in some sort of fantasy world as well. And they even interact with these characters, these adults who are dressed as characters, in ways that are kind of bizarre.
Yeah, one of my, I'm not going to say favorite, but one of the things that jumped out to me the most was that parents will occasionally be so taken in by Mary Poppins that they think, oh, here's a nanny. I can leave my child with them. And then they will leave their children and they will depart. And then Mary Poppins has to take them to a center for lost children in Disney World.
is that a testament to how good Disney is at creating this experience, or a testament to the type of parents who are there?
I think it's both, honestly. Yeah. I mean, people get very carried away. Also, parents are tired. If you're at Epcot, maybe you've been drinking. So, like, you know, you can kind of lose your head a little bit. Another way people lose their head is they will sometimes hit on the costume characters. And when we went into this story, I thought, oh, God, we're going to hear all these, like, kind of not great stories about people hitting on Cinderella. And that was not the case, actually. The number one most hit-on character at Disney is Captain Jack Sparrow.
I get
from
that
Pirates
one, folks.
Of the Caribbean. And women will go up to him and slip their hotel room key into his pocket, one of his many pockets, and say, keep the costume on. I'll be there all night. Which is wild.
What was the wildest thing, or what was he surprised at? Was there something, anything that, like, as he was doing it, like, he just was like, whoa, I didn't expect that?
You know, there is a little bit of shenanigans that go on some of the rides where there's, like, dark and... private areas. So he was a little surprised that people get frisky in those areas. And, you know, everything on Disney at Disney is on camera. So, like, if you're thinking of getting romantic on Splash Mountain, think again. But also, you know, there's like a full circle of life. So, you know, people actually will drop ashes of loved ones in the haunted mansion.
You're not allowed to do that?
You're not allowed to do that. Okay. If you ever walk by it and it's shut down, it's almost certainly because they're closing it because somebody tried to do that and they had to clean it.
Chris, this is really tough work, though. And the people who do this work are very dedicated. What did he find about what it takes to succeed in this role?
I mean, the people that work at Disney, it's not by accident. They are people who love Disney more than the people who pay to go there. So, you know, people very frequently, when they get their Disney name tag that has their name, it says, you know, I'm Chris from Orlando, they will cry. You know, it's very meaningful to them. And they are taught never to become impatient with anybody, and they have to deal with, you can only imagine, you know, people who get really frustrated, people who are going to the bathroom in line, people who ask them, why didn't they build a dome over this park because it's raining? And, you know, why didn't I think of that? Of course, you know what? I'll talk to somebody about that.
Who's Chris from Orlando?
So Chris from Orlando.
It's not Chris Rouser from Orlando.
Is actually, if you forget your name tag, they have just a bunch of Chris from Orlando name tags, and you wear it, and you have to have a name tag to identify yourself when you're working. So if you're Julie from Topeka, you forget your name tag, you're Chris from Orlando for the day.
Poor real Chris from Orlando, who has to wear the name tag
yes.
every day.
And there are some. I do feel for Chris.
I also wonder, is it Brandon comes to ideas with you? Are you guys just like percolating and you've like a little list of things that you want him to do or places to go, kind of not undercover, but just go behind the scenes?
Yeah, we do. We brainstorm a lot for this. And we, you know, we have a dream list of ideas of where we would want him to try to work. And Disney was really like always at the top of the list, and we didn't think we'd get it. You know, we want him to work as a valet at a really fabulous hotel that we've been negotiating with, because we think that might be like a really fun one. But now places approach us.
Do they?
Which is surprising. And some of them...
such a great thing.
Some of them come back.
Like, I want more?
Yeah, like the Plaza Hotel was like, do you guys want to do this again? Because that story from the Plaza Hotel where he was a butler, like... grown-ups ask the butlers to read them stories in bed before they go to sleep. Like, people do...
I'm in for that.
...are very forward.
Was that you, Carol?
Just kidding, no. I'm just kidding.
And they'll do
kidding.
It. The butlers will do it.
All right, can we go to... This is... I know we talked about it recently, so our listeners, I know this might be still fresh in your memory, but I constantly talk about...
It's kind of unreal. It's kind of unreal, though.
And we talk about it on air still every day.
Yeah.
Metaverse and retail, luxury retail. It's a thing.
Yeah, it's really a thing. So we did a story a couple weeks ago about how luxury brands and other designers are beginning to sell goods in the metaverse, you know, and by sell goods, I mean sell things that will never actually exist in real life. So brands like Balenciaga and Gucci and Dolce & Gabbana have had showcases or sales rooms or, you know, they work with platforms so that people can buy a bag online, a costume for a character online, or just fashion that, you know, maybe you'll make an avatar in a virtual world like Roblox or Fortnite or Halo, and you'll just wear it there. A lot of them are attached to NFTs to prove their authenticity. And even the day that we came out with our story, Ralph Lauren announced that they were doing something. So like it's really snowballing now.
Well, how is this helping the businesses? I mean, you think about something that doesn't have any margins, doesn't cost anything to produce, so it has great margins, I should say, and it still has this idea of, you know, when you buy one of these things in real life, there's this element of scarcity to it, and you can recreate that with NFTs too. So it's kind of a perfect fit for luxury.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Luxury has traditionally not been great about adopting the internet and digital ideas. They were very slow to sell any wares online or even have websites at all. But it makes a lot of sense when you think about, okay, you don't have to use the labor to make a dress.
Right.
And, you know, and 3D modeling is difficult, and is some of the things that they are making actually can be quite time intensive, but you don't have to buy any of the resources. And you can sell versions of new things, or you can sell old designs that are in your archive. Private equity could go and find, you know, a defunct company and then buy their archive and just sell it all online as NFTs or in these virtual worlds. So, you know, right now, brands are tiptoeing into this, and they're trying to appeal to communities of gamers and people who are already in these virtual worlds who are used to wearing skins, which are basically costumes or outer shells for game players, or who are just getting into buying items, storing items in their private spaces in virtual worlds, and exchanging them and investing and trying to make money. But you know, this has the possibility of changing the whole game for fashion in the future by cutting down on overstock, cutting down on waste. There's just a lot of possibilities for it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, keep hanging out with us in real life.
Yes.
Happy. I would gladly do that.
Okay.
Well, thanks, we love Chris. Having you. Happy New Year. All right. That's, of course, Bloomberg Pursuit's editor, Chris Rouser. We thank him so much for spending the hour with us. And we just love, love everything his team does. They're just the best. And that wraps up the New Year's weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio, a special edition. Thanks so much for joining us. And welcome to 2022. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into our Bloomberg Business Week daily show. It's Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
Not in the metaverse, at least not yet. You can also watch our daily broadcast. That's on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week. It's available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com. On businessweek.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take. It's available on Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend, everyone, and Happy New Year.
Stay safe. This is Bloomberg.